Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Haunted by Waters and Like the Dust to introduce today's show, in which we look at the unfolding story of this particular oil spill, rather this oil deluge from Deepwater Horizon, and how history, politics, and even the news about it repeat. We also hear from Greg Pallast on the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez spill, and from Rachel Maddow, Laura Flanders, and Liz Decker from Between the Lines on this spill. Meanwhile, The Telegraph in the UK reports that Louisiana officials have accused BP of turning the Gulf of Mexico into a toxic testing ground after winning permission for experimental chemical methods of fighting the oil slick. In their article, BP accused of using Gulf of Mexico as toxic testing ground, the UK states, despite registering concerns about the potential implications for the environment, marine life, and human health, Governor Bobby Jindal's administration was cut out of deliberations over the use of dispersants that break up the oil, as the Environmental Protection Agency granted BP permission to release large quantities underwater. Quote, we don't have any data or evidence behind the use of these chemicals in the water. We're now basically using one of the richest ecosystems in the world as a laboratory, complained Alan Levine, the head of Louisiana's Department of Health and Hospitals. Tony Howard, BP's chief executive officer, told WAFB Channel 9 news station that the chemical has undergone, quote, lots of testing, unquote, and is biodegradable. Quote, we believe it's a very effective way of containing the spill until such time as we can eliminate the leak, he added. But Robert Barnum, the state secretary of the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, stated that it has not been used at such depths before and that its potential impact and consequences are unknown. This includes how it travels through the water over time. Quote, we're very disappointed in their approach, Robert Barnum said. The federal procedures call for a consensus between federal authorities, the responsible party, and the states involved. When we met and I expressed our concerns, apparently they decided to go without us, unquote. Well, I was in the South this last weekend, and thunderstorms were common. As I was departing Little Rock in Arkansas, we were hearing reports that New Orleans was flooding. And I wonder when and if we will hear how the oil and dispersants being used are affected human beings in that area. Laura Flanders of Grit TV aired two short segments of voices of ordinary people from the Gulf trying to make a living in that area. Since Raising Sand Radio focuses on and likes to bring the voices of ordinary people to the air, let's hear Flanders' very short segment.
There are numerous communities hit hard by the spill on the Gulf Coast, and if not entirely shut out of the process, they're definitely not getting any cozy treatment at all. Here's a clip from Green for All's Unheard Voices from the Gulf Coast oil spill.
I was just picking up the shrimp and fish after I looked around because I was tired, and I saw a bright orange light. I thought it was a sunrise, so I just stayed there looking until it came up. So I stayed there for like about 30 minutes, but it just stayed still. It was still dark. And my dad listened to the radio after someone told my dad there's an oil spill or something. After he turned on the radio, and the Coast Guard was saying something about needing help. Because like at least about 15 people died and a lot of people was missing. So after that, the next day, we went back on land.
With the oil spill and the halt in the seafood industry, over 80% of Vietnamese Americans are affected by this. And for the folks living here in New Orleans, and especially in Venice and Burris, where a lot of us live, where it's a lot more closer to the water, that's what they've been doing for the past 20, 30 years. They've been doing this since they're in Vietnam. Vietnamese and non-English speaking communities are particularly affected by this because it's hard for them to understand what's going on. And so right now we're just trying to work to organize folks locally and nationally to get them to come down here to provide assistance with this.
There was Laura Flanders of Grit TV bringing voices of ordinary people from the Gulf. The story of what went wrong and when is coming into focus. Rachel Maddow aired the following piece on the ongoing blame game.
Tonight we have new developments in the investigation into what caused the deadly offshore oil drilling disaster off the coast of Louisiana. We've learned something new about what led up to the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig that killed 11 people. These new developments are not just about what was happening in terms of engineering on board the oil platform. They're about a specific decision that may have led to the explosion, to those 11 people's deaths, and to the still escalating disaster we are facing right now in the Gulf. The Deepwater Horizon, as you know, is a drilling rig. It was actually wrapping up its operation at this site when it blew up. After drilling very, 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 very deeply to the oil there, the Deepwater Horizon was on its way out. Its job was essentially done. Transocean, which owns the Deepwater Horizon rig, and BP, which was leasing it to get to the oil, they were in the process of temporarily capping the well that they had successfully drilled there. They were closing it up. Remember, these offshore oil rigs are mobile. They move around, which is why they're flagged like ships. Deepwater Horizon had finished its job of drilling the well at this site. All it still had to do was safely close off the well, so that well site would be ready for another production rig to come in and re-tap what the Deepwater Horizon had already drilled. And that second rig would actually extract the oil. That's what was going on the day of the explosion. Deepwater Horizon was due to sail away to drill somewhere else after safely closing up the well they'd drilled so somebody else could reopen it. But that is when the explosion happened, when they were in the process of temporarily closing it up after they had drilled it. Last night, in interviews with one of the last people to escape the rig and an engineer investigating the accident for the government, the news show 60 Minutes uncovered and explained a key decision about how to close up that well, a decision made by BP that may tell us why it blew up. Check this out.
Williams says that in a drilling accident 4 weeks before the explosion, the critical rubber gasket called an annular was damaged, and pieces of it started coming out of the well. Here's why that's so important. The annular is used to seal the well for pressure tests, and those tests determine whether dangerous gas is seeping in. So if the annular is damaged, if I understand you correctly, you can't do the pressure test in a reliable way.
That's correct. You may get pressure test recordings, but because you're leaking pressure, they're not reliable.
The morning of the disaster, according to Williams, there was an argument in front of all of the men on the shift between the Transocean manager and the BP manager. Do you know what that argument was about?
Yes.
What was it?
Who's boss?
In finishing the well, the plan was to have a subcontractor, Halliburton, place three concrete plugs, like corks, in the column. The Transocean manager wanted to do this with the column full of heavy drilling fluid, what drillers call mud, to keep the pressure down below contained. But the BP manager wanted to begin to remove the mud before the last plug was set. That would reduce the pressure controlling the well before the plugs were finished. Why would BP want to do that?
It expedites the subsequent steps.
It's a matter of going faster.
Faster, sure.
Who won the argument?
BP.
If the mud had been left in the column, would there have been a blowout?
It doesn't look like it.
To do it BP's way, they had to be absolutely certain that the first two plugs were keeping the pressure down. That life or death test was done using the blowout preventer, which had the damaged gasket.
So, in other words, BP pressured Transocean to plug the well less safely because it would make getting the oil out of the well go faster. Transocean, which is responsible for sealing up this well safely, said, "We'd rather keep the drilling mud in there." But BP, which is paying the bills, won that argument with Transocean. BP got its way, and hours later, the plugging of the well failed, and the rig blew up, and 11 men died, and mass environmental disaster began. When asked to comment on the 60 Minutes report this morning, BP's chief operating officer, Doug Suttles, told the CBS Early Show his focus is stopping the spill and that we should, quote, let the investigations finish up. If there was a market for blame in this disaster, nobody would be selling short in that market. There is plenty of blame to go around. The man in charge of overseeing offshore drilling programs at the already scandal-prone Minerals Management Service in the government has just announced his sudden retirement. He was in charge of the office from 1995 to 2007 before getting promoted. His, quote, retirement comes conveniently enough just days after President Obama promised to end the cozy relationship between the Minerals Management Service and the oil industry it supposedly regulates. Meanwhile, the Minerals Management Service declined to testify in front of the Senate Homeland Security Committee today. Declined to testify. The reason this is important is not because this is hindsight. This is not looking back. This is not trying to find the right lessons learned from a disaster that's in the past. Obviously, the oil is still gushing right this second, so the past isn't even past yet. But there's also the problem of what we've actually got still in the Gulf right now. What we've got right now is, for example, this. This is not an archival photo of the Deepwater Horizon rig before it exploded and sunk. This is now. This is Atlantis. This is 100 miles further offshore than Deepwater Horizon was. It is drilling in water that is more than 2,000 feet deeper than the water that Deepwater Horizon was drilling in. A former BP subcontractor turned whistleblower says BP never reviewed the final design documents for systems and equipment on the Atlantis rig, the photos of which we were just showing you. That means they never confirmed that the rig's equipment was actually built how it was supposed to be built. The whistleblower says Atlantis cannot operate safely without completed blueprints, something that we've seen in action on the Deepwater Horizon disaster. A disaster on Atlantis would presumably be even more gigantic than the Deepwater Horizon's disaster because it's drilling more oil further out and deeper. Today, the whistleblower from this rig, along with a consumer advocacy group, Food and Water Watch, filed a lawsuit to get the Atlantis rig shut down until BP can prove it's safe.
We will have many permutations of the story before we are done, and here is a segment from Between the Lines from last week of what went wrong, and it forms part of our historical record.
For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker. As the British Petroleum drilling rig spill continues to release nearly 5,000 barrels of crude oil a day, wreaking havoc in the Gulf of Mexico, frantic efforts are underway to contain it. 30% of U.S. domestic oil comes from the Gulf of Mexico, most of it from deepwater wells, now that the oil closer to shore has mostly been depleted. The offshore oil and gas industry employs 35,000 workers. Evidence is mounting that BP cut corners to continue production instead of addressing emerging safety issues. Though redundancy was supposed to be built into the system to guard against accidents, British Petroleum apparently chose not to install a deep water valve that could have sealed leaks in case of an accident. The area is also rich in natural gas, and one likely explanation for the explosion that claimed the lives of 11 workers on April 20th is that gas leaked into the concrete seal that Halliburton installed to encase the well in deep water. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kerry St. Pei, executive director of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program, covering the productive and fragile wetlands west of New Orleans. Pei previously worked for more than two decades as chief spill preventer in that region. He spoke by cell phone from the Incident Command Center in Houma, Louisiana, where he was assisting in the joint state-federal response to the disaster.
The absolute worst-case scenario is that this thing is spewing out oil at the rate of 5,000 barrels a day for 90 days. That's the time it would take them to drill a relief well. Oil would be pushed and moved around the Gulf in all directions in accordance with the wind and the currents. It's highly probable that oil would then impact and go inside in the internal estuaries into the Barataria Basin and to the Terrebonne Basin. These are very sensitive areas. That's the nursery grounds. That's where everything begins. All the marine resources, all the birds, everything is in abundance within the estuary. And that would be by far the worst case scenario.
People don't know how bad it's going to get, but do people there consider this a watershed moment, so to speak? I know it's a jobs issue, but maybe there could be other kinds of jobs without this kind of risk to both humans and the environment. And maybe we need to move away from fossil fuels. Is anybody talking about that?
Oh, are people talking about, potential environmental impacts? People are very angry. The fishermen are all angry because a large part of the affected area has been shut down from even fishing. All the boats are tied up in harbors. But, you know, there's questions as to how much safeguards were put in place by this drilling company. That's where the concern is right now. Nobody down here is talking about stopping the offshore drilling or production of oil and gas. People, unfortunately, do need oil and gas, for everything they do in life, powering, their cars, for example. But no one's saying that we shouldn't try to find a alternative fuel. But in the meantime, what are you going to do?
I wonder, just because the Cape Wind project was just approved off Nantucket in the North Atlantic, and it seems like similar conditions might be prevalent offshore in the Gulf of Mexico, is anyone there talking about developing a wind industry?
Yeah, people are talking about wind energy, but that won't replace oil and gas. What this event probably will do, most assuredly, it's going to import more safeguards, even more redundant safeguards, than what were required prior to this.
Carrie St. Pei, do you hear a lot of people talking about just leaving the area, that this is kind of the last straw?
Well, I haven't heard talk about, regarding people moving. The people that fish, are married, so to speak, to the place. Fishing anywhere else in the United States, certainly not internal United States. So I wouldn't, foresee a lot of people moving out because of this incident. But I have seen a lot of anger. People, very confused and just angry that they're losing their livelihood and, wanting to do something, wanting to respond with placing booms out and caused a kind of a frenzy down here. People, sometimes making some incredible accusations and are just really confused as to what can be done and what can't be done in cleaning up the soil. For instance, boom placement. There's people saying that the company isn't putting out enough boom. Well, the weather has been so bad down here that they can't even get the boom deployed. So it's unsafe, plus the winds and seas are blowing the boom far onto land, so they aren't doing any good. And it's useless to place boom when it's not doing any good, when it's not even in the water. So things like that, the people that do this for a living do know what they're doing, and they're not putting boom out during rough seas because they're completely ineffective. So, just fishermen see that, and they are understandably angry, but not justifiably angry.
That was Carrie St. Pei, head of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program in the Louisiana Bayou. Call the program at area code 985-447-0868. Or visit the group's website at btnep.org.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio. I'm Susan Gallimore, host of this weekly hour-long show on Raising Sand Radio. Our website is raisingsandradio.org. And this week we are connecting the growing number of dots associated with oil spills and environmental degradation as the latest catastrophe continues in the Gulf. We are now hearing that oil tar balls are showing up on beaches in Florida, And we at Raising Sand Radio want to ensure that our listeners remember that history repeats itself in this world of oil and chemical contamination. Raising Sand Radio is a project of MotherSpeak and MotherSpeak Media and is fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. Last week, we began to survey our listeners to learn what about Raising Sand Radio you like and what you suggest we could improve upon. There will be a link to this survey again this week, and you will see it when you download the show or go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, or our blogspot, which is raisingsandradio.blogspot.com. Consider giving us your feedback on the show. To date, we've had some excellent feedback. My favorite comment is that the show is unbossed and unbought, and that is true. We do not have anyone breathing down our neck about what we can and cannot air, and there's a wonderful feeling when we hear that our listeners can hear that in our work and that they like that about our work. At the same time, the show is a bit of a one-woman band, and it would be great to have more team members. If you have any audio skills, consider sharing them with Raising Sand Radio. You can send me an email at susan@raisingsandradio.org to learn more about how to do that. We also have a new project beginning. It's called This Is Who I Am and This Is Where I Live, and it focuses on indigenous voices, particularly in the U.S., Palestine, Vietnam, and in South Africa. Of course, South Africa has a number of indigenous groups, and we will focus on the Zulu of the province of KwaZulu-Natal, particularly in the region known as the Valley of a Thousand Hills. We will have small teams in each of these places, and once the project gets underway, we will air voices of ordinary people and how they relate to their land. We will bring personal stories of how the land was traditionally worked, how it is worked now, and what sort of contamination, if any, local people are having to deal with. In all of these countries, again, the U.S., Palestine, Vietnam, and South Africa, the land is under huge pressure to accept contaminating industries or waste dumps or various forms of conflict. Raising Sand Radio will explore these issues and share them with the public to inform and create communities that can reach out over cultural differences and barriers to bring about positive change. We begin with the indigenous people of, again, U.S., Palestine, Vietnam, and South Africa, but we're open to airing similar stories of other indigenous people. If you have access to indigenous communities that you think might be interested in sharing their stories, send me an email. It's susan@raisingsandradio.org. And if you can make a tax-deductible donation to the project, again, it's called This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live, or simply to Raising Sand Radio and our fiscally sponsored organization, MotherSpeak, please do so. While you are at our website, raisingsandradio.org, feel free to download any of our shows that offer a range of progressive topics. 21 years ago, the Exxon Valdez crashed in Alaska. Last year, Dennis Bernstein of Pacifica's Flashpoints aired an interview with Greg Pallas on the 20th anniversary of what was then the world's worst oil spill. I'm going to re-air it here today to connect the dots between what went down then and what is going down now as thousands of gallons of oil a day continue to spew from Deepwater Horizon.
It's been 20 years since the Exxon Valdez went aground in Alaska, devastating 1,200 miles or more of Alaska's pristine coastline with toxic oil. Quote, it also marks the 20th year of a lie, writes Greg Pallast on gregpallast.com, quote, lots of lies. Greg Pallast is one of the key investigators over 18 years ago working with the indigenous population to hold Exxon accountable, but it wasn't to be. And 20 years later, the devastation of the spill is still being felt, and Exxon has been virtually let off the hook. Joining us to talk about Exxon is Greg Pallast. He's the author, among other things, of On Manhouse and the editor of gregpallast.com. He reports for the BBC. Greg, it is good to have you back with us.
Always, Dennis. Always glad to be with you.
Well, let's shoot back to the beginning. Right up top there, Exxon Valdez said the first thing was it wasn't going to be a big problem because the good weather and good conditions essentially wiped the spill away.
Oh, yeah, Mother Nature took care of it all. According to the lazy, well, I won't use the word, the lazy something reporters who don't go up to the Prince William Sound to look at the oil. If they did, kick over rocks over near Chinega on Sleepy Bay, and it still smells like a gas station. It's 20 years later, man. It's, the damage is still there. Mother Nature doesn't wipe your poop for you so easily, especially with the geology of Alaska. And the evil crime, it's kind of ecological Holocaust denial. Exxon just says it doesn't exist. Mother Nature cleaned it up. That's it. If you go to gregpalace.com, you'll in fact see masses of oil cleanup being done by guys in yellow suits. Those are natives, local natives cleaning up their beaches in hazmat suits. Those pictures were taken 7 years after the spill by my BBC crew. And Exxon just said no more cleanups after 7 years, just because they didn't want the PR. They figured no one would care anymore. What, the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, is going to care about what happens to the natives there? She won't even accept unemployment insurance compensation from the federal government, let alone trying to do something for the people who live in the sludge today.
Let's talk about how bad it was then, why it was so bad and got a lot worse based on Exxon's lack of action and preparedness, and what the devastation is that continues.
Well, first of all, let's start out with their lies. I mean, one of the big stories that always comes out is that there's a captain, a guy named Hazelwood, who is drunk, and he ran the boat onto a reef, kind of like a drunk driver at the wheel. That's just complete baloney, Dennis. He was stewed. So was the first mate and the second mate, but they were below deck sleeping it off when the third mate was at the helm. But he's flying the boat, this giant tanker, without the Raycast radar system. Raycast was like the early version of GPS, where you could see even a three-year-old could have taken the tanker through the Valdez Narrows if the radar was on. But it was, at that time, it wasn't a $200 GPS. Those things were, at that time, cost millions to build and to operate, train. So Exxon, after the maiden voyage of the ship, it didn't work, so they kept it off and turned it off, which is against the law, by the way. It's like having no speedometer or something. And so that's why the ship hit the reef. Even then, however, I should note that would not have caused the disaster that we saw. The disaster was caused not only by Exxon's cheaping out on the radar, but even more, by saving millions and millions, even billions of dollars on safety equipment to contain a spill. Tankers hit reefs, they run aground, they spring leaks all the time, Dennis, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that you end up, sludging and sliming 1,000 miles of coastline. What you do, it's real simple. You put a rubber boom, just a big rubber skirt around the ship and its oil, and then you suck it out with a pump into another ship. Well, Exxon promised that they're going to run the water route, which they didn't have to do. If they're going to take oil by water, that they would leave this rubber skirts, these rubber booms, out all over the sound, including right at the place where they hit Bligh Reef, named after Captain Bligh. They were actually supposed to keep equipment right there at the native village, and where if a tanker ever hit there, they could just surround it with the rubber skirt. So it should have been nothing. But there was no rubber skirt there, and there was no ship to suck out the extra stuff that's called a containment ship, because Exxon, despite saying they would never run a tanker without the containment vessel nearby, they ran it anyway, even though the containment vessel was out of commission. It was in a dry dock, and the stuff was locked under ice, the pumps. So you had no radar. Once a ship hit, they had no rubber to contain the oil, which is simple stuff, but they didn't do it because they figured, well, who's it going to check for equipment out in the Prince William Sound except natives, right? They didn't have the ship ready to go, the emergency containment ship. And so you added those things together, and I got to tell you, that's your disaster, but even worse, and here's the ugly, ugly thing, Dennis, it was a crime. And I don't mean that. That's not a metaphor. Before I was a journalist, I was a racketeering investigator. This is criminal activity. I'm not kidding. I use that advisedly. In April 1988, according to my investigation, it's a team. I'll give credit to many people on this. We found memos 10 months before the spill in which Exxon and the oil company chiefs, their chief guy in Alaska, a guy named Theodore Polasek, wrote the chief of Exxon and the chief of British Petroleum, which is their partner, Arco Petroleum, part of British Petroleum, and said, we don't have the equipment that we need that's basically required by law in case there's a spill in the Prince William Sound. And ARCO said, well, then if that's the law, they're British. They say, okay, well, I guess you got to comply. And Exxon vetoed it. Exxon adamantly vetoed spending the money to put out equipment required by law. So what their guys did is they simply signed papers saying the equipment was there. This was the top guys. This is, you're talking the presidents and CEOs of the oil companies meeting in Arizona, April 1988, 10 months before the spill, saying, forget it, we're not going to have any spill equipment up there. 10 months later, the spill happened. That's like, has racketeering conspiracy written all over it, Dennis. All over it.
We're speaking with Greg Palast. We're talking about the 20th anniversary, if you will, of the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska that destroyed hundreds of miles of the Alaska coastline and really went a long way to destroy a way of life, Greg. I guess tomorrow's the 20th anniversary. People are still being devastated and undermined by this action. Who was hurt? Tell us about the people you met and who was hurt on this kind of spill and who is still being hurt.
I actually worked for the Chugach Native Alaskans who, you know, this is native land. It's their islands and their beaches that were destroyed. But you have to understand, it wasn't just, you know, you're not talking about Malibu where there was, by the way, a spill. We're not talking about, gee, your summer house. These people have lived there for 3,000 years. They're the last people in America to actually survive off the land and where they live. And they lived off seal. They lived off clams that they got, deer, et cetera. It was all poisoned, destroyed. The seals were of course, poisoned and died. One native elder, Henry McCarka, was telling me about an otter who he watched an otter just burn his eyes, bring a hive kite and gouge out its own burning eyes. You know, the deer would eat the poison vegetation and die. Eagles were dying because they were eating the poisoned salmon. It was devastation. And when the president of Exxon came for a photo op to the village saying, we're going to take care of everything, Paul Komkoff, a native seal hunter, said, you know, I'm hungry. You guys are dropping McDonald's foods from helicopters. What is that? I mean, where's my seal meat? So they sent in canned seal meat, which was marked not fit for human consumption because it was zoo food. And, you know, these villages have never recovered because the poison was there for years and years and years. Some of the natives were also commercial fishermen. And, of course, who wants, you know, 90-octane salmon? So they went bankrupt. They lost their boats. And Exxon has refused to pay after 20 years. And there was a court judgment against them, $5 billion, which was supposed to go to 30,000 people. And the Supreme Court this past year, the Bush court, John Roberts said, well, you know, why are you picking on Exxon and cut it by 90%? So now after 20 years, people are getting finally their checks, 10 cents on the dollar. So welcome to corporate America. And the president of Exxon, by the way, retired, that was in charge of this fraud, really, received a $400 million bonus on his retirement. I mean, everyone's shaking about AIG. That's twice of all the AIG bonuses combined.
And this treachery by Exxon was premeditated and quite conscious in terms of its brutality all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand. It's not they said, oh, let's have a spill. What they said is, we can save. See, that's the whole thing. This is a profit center. To maintain spill equipment, emergency response teams. They used to hire the natives to go with the tankers because they knew the waters. And they were trained to deal with spills. They had a lot of technical expertise. They knew the waters. They fired all the natives. They got rid of the equipment. They didn't have the containment barges. They refused to have double-hulled boats, which would have also prevented the damage. They saved billions. They saved billions. And when they even had, they would lobby their way out of laws like double-hulled tankers. But even when the law said, they made promises under oath, the top guys at Exxon and British Petroleum and its ARCO unit swore. You're talking about the chairman and CEOs and presidents swore to Congress under oath that they would have spill equipment, that they would maintain the state-of-the-art radar. That was under oath. And they had state-of-the-art radar, but it was off. You know, so, yes, it was, what was premeditated was the penny pinching, or billions of pennies, of course, billions of penny pinching operations, which led to the disaster, and they didn't care because it was like, to them, it's the cost, what they ultimately paid. Now there's 10 cents on the dollar payoff. That's like a license to pollute. As far as they're concerned, it's a license to pollute. If after 20 years, hey, we pay a few bucks. They even told me, Otto Harrison, and I want you to remember his name because I like to name these people. It's not just an empty corporation. General manager of Exxon USA said, hey, you know, we'll outlive you. And they did. Paul Komkoff, the seal hunter, is dead. What's the point of giving him a check now?
Outlive them, huh? Outlive the victim and celebrate your retirement on the backs of entire communities. It does sound like corporate life as usual. Is there any way, is there anything to do, or is this now, as they say, dirty water under the bridge?
Well, a couple things. One, Mr. Obama, he got maneuvered into agreeing to some new offshore drilling, expanded offshore drilling during the McCain-Palin oil panic, you know, drill, baby, drill. Okay. And Obama said, okay, well, we'll open up some more coastal waters to drilling, supposedly because we have new safeguards. Well, we heard about those safeguards before the Exxon Valdez. All the safeguards were there. They lie. They still lie. I mean, I just came back from Ecuador, where Chevron Texaco's pooped all over the Amazon. Please just look at Louisiana. I mean, my God, you know, I mean, yeah, they know how to prevent oil spills. They know how to prevent oil pollution, just that it costs money, and they're not going to spend it ever. Forget it. It won't happen. You know, and they'll never enforce the law because the other aspect of this, and this is not a side issue. As a senator, Obama was a supporter of so-called tort reform, you know, preventing people from filing class action lawsuits, the evil lawyers. Well, you know, I got those documents, I have to tell you. I got those documents about the secret meeting of Exxon and the other oil chiefs before the spill through the legal process, through the Natives lawsuit. They were seeking justice. They were seeking compensation, and we forced Exxon to open its files. And, yeah, we didn't get the money for the Natives that they deserved, but we got a lot of the truth. And that's only because of the right to sue, the right to bring class actions. And I'm just afraid that that last route of justice is being shut down by corporate America. And I'm just afraid that Obama is going to give in to this crap, as he did as a senator, that evil lawyers are filing too many lawsuits against corporations. That's nonsense. There's not enough.
That was Dennis Bernstein and Greg Palast. Now, we end with Between the Lines beginning a report on Chevron's request for film footage.
For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker. Chevron has filed a federal lawsuit against documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger. His 2009 film Crude explores a $27 billion lawsuit against the energy giant for oil pollution in the Ecuadorian Amazon. Chevron wants access to 600 hours of uncut footage left out of the movie. Berlinger is fighting the motion, saying it is a violation of his right to free speech, and compares the uncut footage to a reporter's unpublished notes. Chevron insists uncut footage would help explain events relating to the class action lawsuit now being heard in Lago Agrio, Ecuador. Berlinger insists Chevron's motion would violate confidentiality agreements he made with indigenous Ecuadorians and employees of Chevron. The filmmaker says these agreements were required to gain the trust of key subjects in the documentary. Berlinger concluded, if Chevron is successful in getting a journalist to turn over a work in progress, it would have a chilling effect on this kind of documentary making in the future.
Now, the latest piece in the story about Chevron is that a federal judge in Manhattan last Thursday granted a petition by Chevron to issue a subpoena for hundreds of hours of footage from a documentary about the pollution of the Amazon rainforests of Ecuador and Chevron's involvement. Judge Lewis A. Kaplan, a United States District Court, said that the director of the movie, Crude, Joe Berlinger, would have to turn over more than 600 hours of footage from his documentary, Crude. The film, which was released last year, chronicles Ecuadorians who sued Texaco, which is owned by Chevron, saying that the operations of the oil company's oil field at Lago Agrio contaminated their water. Chevron, which is pursuing an international treaty arbitration related to the lawsuit and seeking to have litigation dismissed, said that Mr. Berlinger's footage would be helpful to the company. It pointed to a scene from Crude in which representatives for the plaintiffs in the Lago Agrio lawsuit take part in a focus group with a neutral court expert, and said that other footage shot by Mr. Berlinger could show further instances of improper collaboration. Lawyers for Mr. Berlinger argued that his footage was protected by his privilege as an investigative journalist and that turning over the film would violate confidentiality agreements with his subjects as well as his First Amendment rights. In siding with Chevron, Judge Kaplan wrote that Mr. Berlinger had not met his burden of showing whether any of his film material was subject to any confidentiality agreements with his sources, and that the release forms he used with his subjects gave him carte blanche to use all of the footage in his production. The judge also noted that Chevron, which once praised Ecuador's legal system, was now arguing that it could become a victim of political influence in that country. Nevertheless, Judge Kaplan cited the maxim of the former Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis that, quote, sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants, and he wrote, review of Berlinger's outtakes will contribute to the goal of seeing not only that justice is done, but that it appears to be done, unquote. Randy Mastro, a lawyer representing Chevron, said in a televote interview on Thursday, quote, we are very gratified by the judge's decision, especially so since he recognized that the time urgency, since he recognized the time urgency here. Through this kind of discovery, we have been exposing corruption, fraud, and the travesty of justice going on in Ecuador. This evidence will be critical to determining Ecuador's violation of international law and its denial of due process and fair treatment to Chevron. Mr. Mastro added that the footage for Crude represented, quote, an extraordinary film record of exactly the kinds of abuses that have tainted the judicial process in Ecuador, unquote. Maura Wogan, a lawyer representing Mr. Berlinger, said in a telephone interview, we're obviously very surprised at the court's lack of sensitivity to the journalist's privilege, which is based on core First Amendment principles. The decision really threatens grave harm to documentary filmmakers and investigative reporters. It's compelling the production of an extraordinary amount of footage. Unquote. Ms. Wogan said the decision to grant the subpoena would create, quote, a fishing expedition through the filmmaker's work, adding it just permits a private litigant to scour through this footage that was created. Unquote. The lawyers for Mr. Berlinger said they would ask Judge Kaplan to stay the subpoena while they appeal the decision of the United States Courts of Appeal for the Second Circuit. Meanwhile, Shell Oil, not daunted by any of this news, will drill, if it gets its way, in Arctic seas this summer. The UK Guardian reports that Shell yesterday pushed ahead with plans to drill in the Arctic Ocean this summer, defying calls for a moratorium on offshore exploration in the pristine wilderness following the Gulf of Mexico disaster. California's governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, this month scrapped plans to allow offshore drilling in the state for the first time in more than 40 years, and environmentalists have called for a halt in the Arctic after Professor Obama opened up the area to drilling for the first time last month. However, Shell today refiled its drilling program with the U.S. authorities after being required to review its safety procedures following the Gulf spill and awaits final permits. The industry will drill the first-ever large wells in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas in the Arctic, which are estimated to hold 27 billion barrels of oil and gas. Shell chief executive Peter Voser told shareholders at the company's annual meeting that it would only drill there if it thought it could be done, quote, safely and responsibly. The characteristics of the offshore fields are different to those in the Gulf of Mexico. We will go less deep so there is less pressure, he said. The world needs these fossil resources in the longer term. Voser said Shell had spent $2 billion to secure the permits. Now, to end on a positive note, according to conventional wisdom, the U.S. is a center-right country. But a new poll by Pew casts doubt on that idea. It shows widespread skepticism about capitalism and hints that support for socialist alternatives is emerging as a major force in America's new generation. Carried out in late April and published May 4, 2010, the Pew poll, arguably the most respected polling company in the country, asked over 1,500 randomly selected Americans to describe their reaction to terms such as, quote, capitalism, socialism, progressive, libertarian, and militia. The most striking findings concern capitalism and socialism. We cannot be sure what people mean by these terms, so the results have to be interpreted cautiously and in the context of more specific attitudes on concrete issues. Pew summarizes the results in its poll title, quote, "Socialism not so negative, capitalism not so positive." This turns out to be an understatement of the drama in some of the underlying data. Yes, capitalism is still viewed positively by a majority of Americans, but it is just by a bare majority. Only 52% of all Americans react positively. 37% say they have a negative reaction, and the rest unsure. A year ago, a Rasmussen poll found similar reactions. Then, only 53% of Americans described capitalism as, quote, superior to socialism. Meanwhile, 29% in the Pew poll described socialism as positive. This positive percent soars much higher when you look at key subgroups. A 2010 Gallup poll found 37% of all Americans preferring socialism as superior to capitalism. Charles Derber, professor of sociology at Boston College and author of Corporation Nation and Greed to Green, writes in a recent article, "Capitalism: Big Surprises in Recent Polls." He writes, "If socialism means a search for a genuine systemic alternative, then America, particularly its youth, is emerging as a majoritarian social democracy, or in a majoritarian search for a more cooperative, green and more peaceful and socially just order. Either interpretation is hopeful. It should give progressives assurances that even in the age of the Tea Party, despite great dangers and growing concentrated corporate power and wealth, there is a strong base for progressive politics. We have to mobilize the majority population to recognize its own possibilities and turn up the heat on the Obama administration and a demoralized Democratic Party. If we fail, the right will take up the slack and impose its monopoly capitalist will on a reluctant populace." Something to look forward to. And that is our show for the week. Again, if you missed it earlier, Raising Sand Radio and our fiscally sponsored organization Mother Speak has a new project called This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live. We focus on indigenous voices, particularly in the U.S., Palestine, Vietnam, and in South Africa, and we focus on the Zulu in the province of KwaZulu-Natal in the region known as the Valley of a Thousand Hills. The project called This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live will have small teams in each of these places, and once the project gets underway, we will air voices of ordinary people and how they relate to the land. We will bring personal stories of how the land was traditionally worked, how it is worked now, and what sort of contamination, if any, local people are having to deal with. In all of these countries, again the U.S., Palestine, Vietnam, and South Africa, the land is under huge pressure to accept contaminating industries or waste dumps or various forms of conflict. Raising Sand Radio will explore these issues and share them with the public to inform and create communities that can reach over cultural differences and barriers to bring about positive change. We will begin with indigenous people of the U.S., Palestine, Vietnam, and South Africa, but we are open to airing similar stories of other indigenous people. If you have access to indigenous communities and you think they may be interested in sharing their stories, send an email to me at susan@raisingsandradio.org. And if you can make a tax-deductible donation to the project, This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live, or simply to Raising Sand Radio and our fiscally sponsored organization, Mother Speak, please do so. While you are at our website, raisingsandradio.org, feel free to download any of our shows that offer a range of progressive topics. Again, contact me at susan@raisingsandradio if you want to know more about any of this. And thanks for listening, and join us again next week. We will be talking to members of the Vietnamese delegation that was in the U.S. to request redress from the millions of gallons of Agent Orange sprayed over their country during the Vietnam War. And let's go out with Dave Rovix and After the Revolution.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright. And a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma. on many a factory floor. The workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors swung open, mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumi and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now. After the revolution, debts were all forgiven in all the Neo colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees. After the Henry Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief. After the revolution, solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks, organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks, and all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm. After the revolution, all the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion